Well, what does it mean to truly believe that Jesus rose from the dead? I was chatting to someone in the congregation about faith earlier this week, and I gave the illustration of somebody going abseiling. So imagine you're on the top of a cliff. What faith does it take to jump off the edge and to abseil? There can be a misplaced faith. If somebody thought, oh, I don't need the ropes, I'll just climb down myself, I'll be fine. That would be a misplaced faith. That'd be very foolish. It ultimately would probably lead to that person's death. And many people think that the Christian hope is that kind of faith, is a faith against the evidence. It's a silly kind of faith, that we believe something that is clearly not true. I want to convince you this morning that believing that Jesus rose is not jumping off a cliff in foolishness, believing that you'll land safely. But faith is also not just head knowledge. So maybe somebody could be at the top of that cliff, they've got their abseiling gear, they know it's all secure, they know other people have got down safely, they're absolutely certain that this is not going to cause their death. But they can't bring themselves to step over the edge. Is that true faith? Well, it's a head faith, a knowledge, but it hasn't turned into action. Now, a true faith would say, yes, I know this harness is safe. I know I will get down securely. And despite the butterflies in the pit of the stomach, maybe the uncertainty, the willingness to step over the edge and trust that rope. That is true faith. And so what we're going to talk about this morning is the two aspects of believing that Jesus came from the dead. First of all, you do need that head faith. You do need to know that it's not a bulge jump in the dark, that the harness is secure, that Jesus really did rise. And that's what we'll consider in the first half of our sermon. Has he really risen? But then in the second part, we'll think about what does it mean for us to step over the edge, to have our lives transformed by a belief in the resurrection. So that's the two parts of this service. First of all, has he risen? Now let me just acknowledge that, first of all, it might seem like the Easter story is crazy, that it is the equivalent of jumping off a cliff. The idea that someone can rise from the dead is, of course, not normal. It is, of course, something that we wouldn't generally believe. However, I think there is good reason to believe that in the case of Jesus, resurrection from the dead is sensible. It is reasonable. You can say that Jesus didn't rise, but if you do that, you have to come up with an alternate explanation. An alternate explanation for the fact that there was a wandering homeless man in Judea 2,000 years ago whose followers all were willing to die and did die, apart from one, for the belief that he had risen from the dead. And that there is a reason why this faith in a crucified man has persisted for 2,000 years, such that he is the most worshipped human being in the world today. So what are the alternative explanations? Well, let me give you some. These are kind of best explanations for the Easter story from those who don't believe it. There is the swoon theory. Now, the swoon theory says this, that when Jesus was on the cross, he didn't die, he swooned, which sounds like a Victorian lady kind of fainting, but it just means he passed out. He physically passed out, and he seemed so dead that everyone took him to be dead, but actually he'd survived. That's the swoon theory. We'll come back to that in a moment. Secondly, there's the hysteria theory. The idea that the disciples were so overwhelmed with grief, they just saw what they wanted to see. They just built them up to believe that Jesus really had risen, even though they hadn't seen him. Thirdly is the conspiracy theory that the disciples said, well, we're going to be in a bad situation here, boys, if we say Jesus has died. I know. Let's take the body, let's hide it, and let's tell everyone that Jesus rose from the dead. That's the conspiracy theory. And then finally, you get the myth theory. And the idea of the myth theory is that nobody originally believed that Jesus had risen from the dead. They believed he was a good teacher, he died. But over hundreds of years, the myth developed. And so Christians began to believe that Jesus wasn't just a good teacher, but he was God and that he'd risen from the dead. Now, I think there are good reasons to reject each one of those. Let me go through each in turn. First, the swoon theory, the idea that Jesus didn't die on the cross, but he swooned, that he passed out. Have a look at verses 43 to 45 in Mark 15. It says this: Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Now, you might be surprised that he was surprised, but let me explain why he was surprised. Crucifixion was not meant to be a quick process. The reason that the Romans did crucifixion was it was the longest and most torturous death they could imagine. So the idea that Jesus had already died was quite a surprise to Pilate. So what did he do? Well, he checked. Summoning the centurion, he asked if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. So it was surprising that Jesus had died so quickly to Pilate. But he got his soldiers to confirm that it was the case. These soldiers killed people all the time. They crucified people all the time. They made sure the other two men were dead. Moreover, it's actually not a surprise when you hear the whole of Jesus' story that he did die quicker than the others. He had been flogged within an inch of his life on the same day he was crucified, which wouldn't have happened to the other men. Even as he approached the cross, he was too weak to carry the beam. It's not a surprise that he died so quickly. No one at the time suggested this theory as being true. Even Jesus' enemies didn't claim that he'd survived the crucifixion. It was a public event. They'd all seen it. And even if it had happened, even if they'd all been fooled, he would have been incredibly incapacitated. He would have been broken. He couldn't have moved a huge stone away from the grave. So I don't think it makes sense to believe that the swoon theory is true. Jesus couldn't have seemed to have died and then convinced everyone that he was risen from the dead. If you saw a man who'd nearly died and had been passed out for 3 days, wandering around, you wouldn't be convinced he was risen from the dead. You'd be convinced he needed some medical attention right here, right now. So I don't think the swoon theory stands up. Next is the hysteria theory. And you can understand the idea here. There are times when humans see things that they want to see. Maybe it's the case that the people around Jesus' death just got hysterical. They were so overwhelmed with grief. They'd heard all these stories that Jesus was going to raise from the dead. They just convinced themselves it had happened. Now, it can happen that one person can have a vision in a state of hysteria that they have seen someone come back to life. But is it likely that three people, all at the same time, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome, all had such a vision? In fact, we learn in other gospel accounts it wasn't just three people at once. On one occasion, 500 people saw Jesus on one occasion. 500 people cannot have the same delusion. And it still doesn't make sense of why the tomb was open. The Jewish leaders wanted to convince everyone that Jesus hadn't risen from the dead. If Jesus was in the tomb, they'd have rolled it open the tomb and pointed it out. But they didn't. Moreover, the women don't actually seem hysterical in this story from what we can read. They go to anoint Jesus' body for burial. That's exactly what you would do. They had to wait because it was a Sabbath day rest. You can't work on the Sabbath. But they went there to anoint Jesus' body for burial. They weren't expecting him to raise from the dead. And in fact, look at the end of the story. It's actually incredible, the ending that we have. Verse 8, trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Even after seeing this angel, they were still overwhelmed with shock and bewildered. They didn't go and tell people. They don't sound like people who are so overwhelmed with grief that they're convinced it's true. Quite the opposite. You might notice, if you've got a Bible, that there are verses 9 to 20, which are in italics in modern translations, and they say, the earliest manuscripts and some of the other ancient witnesses do not have verses 9 to 20. And that's because verses 9 to 20 go on to add a few different bits that are true, that are from the other Gospels, but they were added at a later date. They weren't written by Mark. They were added by someone who thought, you can't end the Easter story like that. You can't end the story with them fleeing and being afraid. It doesn't make sense that the earliest gospel accounts would have the women trembling and being afraid if they were so hysterical they'd convinced themselves it was true. The most popular in Jesus' day was the conspiracy theory. The Jewish leaders said the disciples must have stolen the body. And for most of Christian history, that has been the explanation most people have gone with. But does that make sense to the evidence we see? First of all, this comes with the assumption that life was easy for the disciples. If the disciples were welcomed as conquering heroes, people gave them their money, people gave them their respect, people gave them power, you would understand why they'd have a vested interest in pretending Jesus rose from the dead. The reality is very different. They were abused all their lives for talking about Jesus. All but John died for their faith, and John was awaiting execution when he died. At one point, one of them could have said, you know what, I don't want to be crucified for something that's not true. It isn't true. I've been telling a lie all this time. But they didn't. And actually, the gospel account itself makes this unlikely. Look at how the disciples are presented. The last time the disciples are mentioned doing something, apart from being told, the women being told to go and tell them, the last time they're mentioned, we read, then everyone deserted him and fled. You want to make yourself look good. You don't want to be telling that story to people. And if they wanted to make themselves look good and get respect and power and authority, why would they have the women as witnesses? Now, this is very misogynistic. It's not what the Bible says. But in courts at the time, in Roman and Jewish courts, the testimony of a woman counted for nothing. In the eyes of people in that time, a woman's testimony would count like a toddler's testimony in our day. They're too silly to understand what really happened. You can't listen to them. Now, that's wrong. The Bible isn't saying that's right. But if you're making up a story, you don't go and make your first witnesses people who wouldn't be trusted. Surely you'd make up your first witnesses as you yourselves. We went, we saw the body, we know it certainly. And why end the gospel so strangely? We said it's unusual. They added that extra ending just to kind of tidy it up some Christians later in history. Because it seems like a really odd way to end. This is the first gospel that was written, and it ends with the women trembling and running away. Why would you do that if you were trying to convince people of something that would make you look good? Now, I said that for most of Christian history, the conspiracy theory has been the most accepted. Probably nowadays, the most accepted is the myth theory. Because we know in human history that often historical events get mythologized. So take the example of the Iliad. The Iliad was the most important book in the ancient Greek and Roman worlds. It describes the events of the Siege of Troy. Now, we don't know for certain whether the Siege of Troy happened, but if it did happen, it would have happened in 1200 BC. The Iliad was written in 800 BC, 400 years later. And actually, the first manuscript of it is even later than the New Testament manuscripts, but we'll put that to one side. That's 400 years there. You can understand how the history became mythologized. Maybe there was a war between this place called Troy and Greece, whether it was about Helen of Troy, whether there was a big horse that got let in with people coming down, whether the gods did all of their actions to and fro, whether Achilles really got shot in the heel. Probably what most likely has happened is that that story in the telling has been mythologized. It's been made more interesting. It's been the equivalent of a film where they've added in mythological elements nowadays, and then people have believed it really happened. And people will say, well, this is what happened with the Bible. Jesus was a great teacher, no doubt, and his early disciples, they just went around and they taught this teaching, but then over time, people got carried away, and they thought that Jesus was God, that he rose from the dead, and then this became the accepted facts. The problem with that is the dating. If we assume that Jesus died somewhere between 31 and 33 AD, Mark was probably written around 65 AD. So you're talking 30 years after the event. People still around. Many people would have seen it. They'd have known what had happened. And at this very early stage in Christian history, people already believed that Jesus had risen from the dead. They believed in resurrection from the start. This wasn't something that developed later in history. From the very off, people believed this. Which means you have to consider why it is they were so convinced if they saw the events that this happened. If you want to know what myths are like, have a Google of the Gospel of Pseudo-Peter. It's called Pseudo-Peter because it's not really written by Peter. It's written by someone pretending to be Peter. And it's an account from hundreds of years after the Gospel of Mark was written. And in it, when Jesus rises from the dead, Jesus walks out of the tomb, and behind him comes the cross. And Jesus says something, and then the cross says something as well. That's myth, and it did happen. People did mythologize these events. But what happens in Mark is very close to the historical. It's telling you lots of facts. It's telling you where things happened, who the people were, what their surnames were. It's written as history. And at the very least, Mark believed Jesus rose from the dead. And that shows that other Christians did as well. So you've got to ask, why were these people convinced? Now, it is difficult to understand, to believe that a human being can raise from the dead. But let me put it this way. Every single person has got to believe in some sort of a miracle. For a Christian, we believe that the world was created by a God who's able to bring life from death. That the universe came from him, that he gave life. And that when he came to the earth as a human being, he was able to take life again. If you're an atheist, you've got to believe that the whole universe rose not just from death, but from non-existence into existence. That it just happened. And then you've got to try and figure out why it is that so many people were convinced in the reality of Jesus. So don't think that all the questions come on the Christian side. Now, I imagine if this is the first time you've heard it, I don't think I'll have convinced you in, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, however long this has been. You're going to need time to think about it. You'll need to look both sides of the argument. You'll need to see more evidence for the Bible. I completely understand that. But at least acknowledge this, that those who believe Jesus rose from the dead are not just jumping on a cliff. They're not just believing a fairy tale that makes it feel happier when we stand around a graveside. But there is real evidence that Jesus rose from the dead, and that no other explanation, as far as I can see, makes sense. And Christians, it's not just those who aren't Christians who need to hear this kind of thing. Doubts do come to all of us, don't they? There are times when we start to doubt whether Jesus really did rise from the dead, whether it's worth all the sacrifices that we're making. Well, begin to understand these things, maybe look into them deeper if it's something you struggle with. If I ever doubt, I ask myself two questions. I told you this before. One, where did the universe come from? How did life come from non-existence? Doesn't make sense. A scientific worldview explains so much, but it can't explain non-existence birthing existence. And then secondly, I ask, how do you explain that the disciples were willing to give their lives in the belief that Jesus rose from the dead? I can't ever get around those two things. And that's why I have to believe in Jesus. And it's good for us as Christians to be reminded that this isn't just a hope in the dark. This is based on the solid evidence. However, we can believe this is factually true, and yet we still haven't gone the whole way. Like that person stood on the edge of a cliff who knows that the harness is secure, who knows that people have got down safely, who knows there is no possible chance that they're going to die abseiling, but doesn't go over the edge of the cliff. We need to not only believe it to be true in our heads, we need it to make a difference in our lives. So we've asked, is he risen? And now we ask, if he is risen, then what? How should we behave? Well, the key that comes through Mark's account is that we shouldn't be afraid anymore. There are three groups of fearful people that are mentioned that show us what it means to believe the resurrection. The first are the women. And in a sense, they are a bad example to us, but we'll explain why that is. The women are filled with fear. Verses 1 to 6 of chapter 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him." Now, Becky's already explained to us why the women were alarmed when they saw the angel, because angels aren't pretty little girls in dresses in nativity plays. They are warriors. In the Old Testament, if an angel appeared, 9 times out of 10, it meant that somebody was going to die. There was going to be a judgment coming from God. And even if it was someone who wasn't about to be judged, they generally felt overwhelmed with fear, and they were never told to stop that fear. Think of Isaiah going and beholding heaven and saying, "Woe to me, for I am a man of unclean lips." It's right to be fearful of angels. They are terrifying, and they represent God's judgment and God's perfectness. However, they're not to be alarmed now. Why not? Because something has happened. Jesus has died. He's paid the price for their sins. And that means they don't need to be afraid in the presence of angels anymore, afraid of the sin that stains them. They don't need that fear. They are coming as equals because they are clothed in what Jesus has done. It goes on, "But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Why on earth does he end in that way? We look at that and we say, "What are you doing, women? Jesus is risen from the dead. You should be going and celebrating. You should be going and telling everyone. Why would you be afraid? Why would you keep this news to yourself?" But then the question turns around on us, doesn't it? And we start to ask, well, hang on. How do I respond believing that Jesus has risen from the dead? It has certainly been the case of Mark's original readers. I think this is why Mark ends in this way. For those of you who've been coming on an evening series, for our evening series, 1 Peter is written about the same time as Mark. And you'll know that there was great persecution in Rome at the time, that Christians were set on fire in Nero's garden parties, the emperor's garden parties. That was the kind of world they were in. Should you be scared? Yeah, of course you should be scared in that kind of environment. However, Mark is telling them that because Jesus has risen from the dead, they don't need to be trembling and bewildered and afraid, because they have a hope that goes beyond death. That even being killed, even being tortured for their faith is worth it because of what lies beyond. Now, if the women didn't need to be afraid, and those persecuted Christians didn't need to be afraid, well, how should we be? Too often we're afraid to even admit we are Christians when all we'll get is maybe a rolling of the eyes or a snarky comment. If Jesus has risen from the dead, then the response of verse 8 is the wrong response. And we should be completely changed. The way we should behave is actually the way Joseph of Arimathea behaved. Do you remember him? Verse 43, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. This was an immense risk. He's a member of the Jewish council, the people that put Jesus to death. Jesus has died. At this point, you're probably going to say, you know what? I was wrong to back the Jesus horse. Maybe I'll leave it be. But actually, this man decides after Jesus' death, not only to say, I did believe in him who we crucified, but actually to go and stand before Pilate and say, give me his body. That's an incredible boldness. And he had that boldness, not even knowing that Jesus had risen from the dead. And that's to be an example to us. Perhaps if you're a newer Christian, you've only recently been convinced that Jesus is who he says he is, you still feel that little shyness about coming out and saying, yes, I am a Christian. I'm going to give my life to him. I'm going to be baptized publicly. I'm going to start coming to church, serving in the church. I'm going to tell everyone that I believe in Jesus, whatever they say. That's a part of you holding back from that. And I understand that. We all do. But if Jesus has risen from the dead, and if Jesus has died for your sin, then you should boldly be willing to stand even before the likes of Pilate and say, I want him with me. And Christians, we need to do the same. We have much more reason for confidence than Joseph of Arimathea, don't we? We need to keep going. We need to keep being bold in our faith because of what we believe to be true. The final fearful person you might not have spotted is Peter. Do you remember where we left Peter? Peter, in the Easter story, followed Jesus when he was going to trial. And he sat outside. And one of the servant girls there says, you were with that Nazarene Jesus. And Peter denies it. And someone else asks him and he denies it. And then someone else asks him and he denies it. And then the cock crows, as Jesus predicts. And Peter broke down and wept, we are told. And then, the next time Peter's name is mentioned is in verse 7. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. Why say and Peter? Because Peter's one of the disciples. You could have said, go and tell the disciples, and the women would have assumed that Peter would be included in that. So why did the angel's message, God's message, specify Peter? It was because Peter was no doubt thinking to himself, he couldn't possibly mean me. I've denied him. I've rejected him. I've given up the chance to be a disciple. I can never be forgiven for that rejection of him. But that message says, tell the disciples and Peter, doubting Peter, who feels that he doesn't deserve to be welcomed back, tell him, I'm going to meet with him as well. And we know from John's gospel that when he met Peter, he reinstated him as one of his disciples. And that ultimately tells us what the Easter story is about. Perhaps you're here this morning and you're thinking, you say it's good to come to Jesus, to confess him, to believe in him, to follow him, but Jesus wouldn't want someone like me. You don't know what I've done. You don't know how much I've rejected him. You don't know the way that I've treated him. I used to believe in him, and then I just ran away and went after the things of this world, and now I can't even pretend to come after him. Well, this story tells you that if Jesus was here this morning, he would say to me, Tim, tell the people of Wheelock Heath and that one that they can be forgiven. Every single person in this room, just like Peter, is offered the chance of eternal life, whatever they have done. So your sin never needs to keep you from coming to Jesus, no matter how many times you've let him down. because Peter, who let him down, was welcome too. And Christians, that can give us great assurance too. Because often we'll look at our lives and it will be like Peter. Sometimes we'll be dead bold and proclaiming our faith, and then other times we completely let God down. And we might think, have I done it this time? Am I going to be rejected this time? And Jesus would say, no. Tell the disciples and Peter, tell the disciples and every single person in that room who has trusted in me that their sins can be forgiven. So in conclusion, what have we seen? Well, let's go back to that abseiling example. Believing Jesus rose from the dead is not jumping off a cliff. It's not lunacy. It is a certain, as sure a hope as knowing that those harnesses are secure. But when you believe the harnesses are secure, the true test of whether you really believe is whether you will walk off the edge. And in terms of the Easter story, it's whether you will not be afraid. It's whether you can say, even though this terrifies me, the idea that Jesus rose from the dead, I'm going to believe it. Even though I know that that will mean telling people I believe in Jesus that I fear to tell, I will boldly do it. Even though I fear that I won't be accepted, I will believe that when he says, and Peter, he means me too. I hope this morning that you'll believe in your head that Jesus rose from the dead. But more than that, I hope that you will take that step of faith that goes beyond the head knowledge to the practice, to not fear and to trust that Jesus really is the one who can save you from your sins and raise you from the dead.